Madhuwaha Winchina Galvia, agus Fáilte Gí Galway Talks, Lum Hain, John Morley. Coming up on the programme today, we have a jam-packed show. We look at the Israel-Iran conflict with two local politicians indeed, as well as that Sudan's humanitarian crisis 1 year on. We discuss that with some of the Jesuits from the west of Ireland who are out there doing great work. We have a look at diabetes and empathy kits which are being used with someone from the University of Galway. There is a Labour European election candidate from Ormore Murray. He comes into studio. As well as that, we have Galway and the East Simon dip a day in May. The Galway Musical Society's Oliver production kicks off tomorrow night. All that plus lots more coming up between now and 12 noon, including Galway greats. This time, the turn of Heather Higgins. All that plus lots more coming up on Galway Talks. And a very good morning to you. Welcome into today's programme with Galway Talks with me, John Morley. I must say at the outset that I'm very excited to get stuck into the new job, and I want to wish Keith all the health and happiness in retirement. I've enjoyed working with him over the past year and a half or 2 years as well, and I will miss him dearly, but I know he's listening in this morning. I've been harassing him this morning already. So thanks for Keith for everything, and we look forward to hearing from you in the not too distant future as well. Now though, I want to go to the big international topic over the weekend, and indeed over the past few weeks and months as well. It's the Israel conflict and that whole Middle East conflict. And I suppose it stepped up a notch over the weekend with the missiles being fired from Iran in response to the April 1st alleged attack by Israel on the consulate in Damascus. To discuss this further, I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line now by Galway Independent Deputy Catherine Connolly, and also by the leader of Seanad Éireann, Lisa Chambers, who is a senator and also a European election candidate as well. You're both very welcome on to Galway Talks this morning. And Deputy Connolly, I might start with you first. Good morning. Now, Deputy Connolly, you were at this protest that was at Shannon Airport yesterday. Talk to us about that aspect first. There's a lot of pressure being put on, I suppose, people in Ireland to, I suppose, take on the US in terms of not allowing them to be using Shannon as a base to then go to Israel.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to re-quote the General Secretary of the UN, Antonio Guterres, who said we're on the brink. And I think for me and for listeners, listen to that, we're on the brink. And what are we on the brink of? Certainly a regional war and with a huge potential for a third world war. So Ireland as a neutral country has a vital role in stopping this escalation and stopping the warmongers. We have three men in charge of a war cabinet in Israel: Netanyahu, the former Israel defense minister, and the current one. And that war cabinet are meeting secretly and determining when they will have their revenge. And that's where we are now in the 21st century. I was in at Shannon yesterday, and I stood proudly and sadly with protesters. And words actually failed me when I was asked to say a few words, because our compassion for the people of Palestine is palpable. People were actually crying yesterday in helplessness at what is happening in Palestine. Now, I'm on record for condemning the attack by Hamas back on the 7th of October, unequivocally. And you know, I'm tired saying that. But the response by Israel has been out of proportion. It has been revengeful, and they've used those words themselves. They have killed children, women and men, and continue to do so with the active support of America, of Germany and of other countries. And so yesterday, once again, I joined the group that courageously stand every month and say, stop using Shannon as a military transit station for troops, American troops. And I'm not sure if listeners are aware that millions of troops have gone through Shannon over the last 24 years, and also arms. And whom we are asked to give evidence of that. And other than the brave people who are keeping a record of the planes and the number of planes, when they come in and where they go to, they cannot get on board. And the government refuses to check what's on board. Why? Because they've taken the reassurance of our friends and our allies, America, that there are no guns and weapons. Now, can you imagine asking us to take the reassurance of a country that fought a war in Afghanistan illegally and Iraq 2 years later in 2003. Can you imagine taking the word of that simply because they're our friends? And I would like to think that a good friend of mine would tell the truth to me and hold me to account. In this case, we're letting millions of troops, clearly armed. We have no idea whether cluster ammunition has gone through Shannon, which is banned. And we were instrumental in banning cluster ammunition back in 2008. And we have no idea what's going through Shannon. That's why I was down there yesterday. But I pay tribute to the group of people, Edward Horgan amongst them, who have gone down month after month to highlight the situation in Shannon.
Okay, I want to give Senator Lisa Chambers a chance to respond there. Lisa, you are the Fianna Fáil spokesperson on foreign and European affairs. Is Ireland using Shannon Airport as a place for the US military to drop off on the way to the Middle East?
Good morning, John. And first, can I say congratulations to yourself on taking over Galway Talks. Fantastic to see you taking over the role.
Thank you.
And just to wish Keith Finnegan the very best. I've become very accustomed to his voice over the years, but it's been a very smooth changeover. So best wishes in the new role. I think from our own perspective as a country, it's been well acknowledged. And I would agree with Catherine's words about this Palestine and the outpouring of grief and support from the Irish people. We have a long affinity and connection with the Palestinian people because of our own colonisation and our shared history and many, I suppose, shared values as well with those people. And that's why Ireland has been leading from the front, from the very get-go. We were one of the first countries to come out at the outset, obviously condemning the October 7th attack again on Israel, and we all agree with that. Mm. But at the very outset of this conflict, Ireland was one of only four member states to block a resolution at an EU level that was going to block aid going to Palestine. So from the very outset, we have stood strongly and squarely
and
with the people
of
Palestine.
I accept all that, Lisa, but are we using it as a military base? Are we allowing the US to stop off in Shannon Airport with arms and military personnel? Is that happening?
Well, US soldiers do go through Shannon. That's been happening for many, many years. That's fact. That's well documented.
So are we talking out of two sides of our mouth then?
What Ireland has been doing in terms of our response and our role, and not overstating our ability to impact on this conflict either, let's be realistic about our place in the world, but we have been using our voice as a small member state at an EU level, at a UN level. We continue to fund UNRWA when other countries pulled back and blocked funding. We've come out just there, the Taoiseach, a number of days ago, Tuesday last week, said that Ireland would now move to formally recognise the state of Palestine. Mm. And Micheál Martin detailed 6 months of behind-the-scenes work quietly done with other member states to try and get a coalition of member states that are focused on peace and conflict resolution to give Palestinian statehood its true recognition, to give hope to the people of Palestine that there is global support for what's happening there and to support them in becoming an independent state and a two-state solution. So I think Ireland has done a very good job, and really as a small country, I think we've been a really loud and strong and forceful voice for peace in the region. And, you know, when we look at what happened with the attack by Iran on Israel, straight away Micheál Martin was out, the Taoiseach was out to condemn the attack, the EU condemned the attack, the US have condemned the attack because we want to see a de-escalation of conflict in the region. Mm. And, you know, I've been out in the doors as a canvassing for the European elections, and I often do get asked, you know, why are we speaking so much about these issues that are happening so far away? And the point I will always make is that we see the impact when people are displaced and global conflicts on our own country. Mm. We're not living in isolation. These global conflicts affect all of us. And I do think the Irish people want to see, you know, the Irish government and their ministers supporting the Palestinian people and being that voice for peace. And that's what we're good at, you know, as UN peacekeepers and peace enforcers over many decades. We are seen on the international stage as a voice for peace, and we will continue to do that. And I do think that the potential escalation now in the Middle East, as Catherine has outlined, is hugely worrying. And that is why global leaders right across the world have asked Israel to not retaliate, to not escalate this any further, and have condemned Iran for what they have done. So I do think we are in a very precarious situation. We could see an escalation of conflict in the region, and that would have impacts for every corner of the globe. Ireland would be impacted as well. And that's why we continue to discuss these issues on Galway Bay and other radio stations. And it has become a national issue because these conflicts do impact here as well.
And I accept that the government have been a voice for peace, but are we being hypocrites if we're being a voice for peace and not being military lined, but we're allowing US military personnel pass through our airports on the way to the Middle East. Is that not hypocrisy of the highest order?
I don't believe that it is. We are close friends and allies of the United States for many, many decades. Many Irish people have made their homes in the US, and many US citizens have made their home here in Ireland. We have many people working for US companies here, and many US citizens working for Irish companies in the US. So our friendship and our connection over many, many decades is long established, and they are close friends and allies of Ireland and will continue to be so. And I don't think people want to see us break that friendship or that tie, and I'm sure that's not what's been suggested.
Is it a case of money over humanity?
No, of course not. And I think anybody suggesting that would be the Irish position, I think people will have to look at Ireland's record on Palestine over many, many decades, on other conflict situations. Mm-hmm. We have continued and will always be a voice for peace. And any opportunity, Micheál Martin as our Foreign Affairs Minister and our Taoiseach Simon Harris and our Leo Varadkar have had on this conflict, they have always advocated for a two-state solution. There's no situation where neither Israel or Palestine will cease to exist. Both countries have to be able to coexist in a peaceful way and people be able to live their lives. And the conflict has to stop. And what's happening, while we condemn the October 7th attacks, Israel's response since then has been totally disproportionate and abhorrent. It is a genocide. They are enforcing famine on the ground there, and they are killing aid workers. And I do believe that in time they will be brought to justice for those war crimes, and I fully support that. And I know the colleagues across the political divide do as well. We are not in this country, we are not divided on this issue. And I always make the point that we should never seek to stoke anger domestically to suggest that some parts of our government or our country are not supporting Palestine. We are all on the same page, I believe, on this conflict. We want peace, and we want the conflict and the killing to stop.
Deputy Catherine Connolly, I'll give you the chance to respond there. Are you all on the same page?
See, I welcome what Lisa has said, that what's happening in Palestine at the moment is genocide. I welcome that clear declaration. That hasn't been the position of government. They were most uncomfortable with the word genocide. And I pointed out that I condemned unreservedly the attack by Hamas. However, in condemning that, there was no opportunity to say what was the context, what had happened in Palestine up to that point, not to mention what has happened afterwards. And every step of the way, the people of Ireland have forced the government to respond, absolutely forced it. And to give you a concrete example of that, a second one, in addition to the reluctance to use the word genocide, prior to that, Amnesty some years ago reported that Israel were operating in an apartheid state. Operating an apartheid state. That's a very well-respected organisation. The government said they were most uncomfortable with that word and it wouldn't be helpful. In relation to our friendship with America, my family, as everybody's family in this country, have intimate connections with America. In a sense, that's immaterial at this point when we're talking about genocide. And genocide by Israel of the Palestinian people. Listen to those words now. We never thought we would hear them again after the Second World War. Genocide, as we speak, aided and abetted by America because they're supplying the arms. So they're continuously saying that ironclad support for Israel while at the same time calling on Israel to show restraint. That's extremely difficult, isn't it? Two different messages and supplying the arms. Indeed, Israel couldn't continue now with their war without the active support of America, Germany, France, and so on. In relation to Palestine itself, the people never had a chance, actually. Way before the Balfour Declaration in 1917, way back in the 19th century, it had been determined that there would be an Israel state by a group of Zionists who came together. This is all factually set out in history. And so the Balfour Declaration copper-fastened a state for Israel, ignoring completely that the Palestinian people were living there. And then 750,000 were put on the roads and literally thrown out to long-term non-statehood. Now, I could go on, but I'm trying to give a context here very quickly because I'm not sure what time I have.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about the attack on the 7th of October, 6 months ago, that came on top of the siege of Gaza by Israel. Before the attack, 500 trucks were needed on a daily basis to go in to feed the people of Gaza. 500 trucks. Since then, there are famine, pestilence, destruction, not to mention the toxic legacy of what's been put down, bombed daily. Toxic legacy on the soil, the sea and the water. All for what? Because Israel are saying they are afraid and they're exercising their right to self-defense, when really they're exercising their right to revenge. And what we need are cool voices. And Lisa started off by saying we shouldn't overstate our position. We have no choice but to raise our voice as an independent, sovereign, neutral state to say, stop this. This is utter madness. We need peace talks. And part of the peace talks has to be Gaza and Hamas. We were able to sit down with the IRA. The violence sickened me of the IRA and the bombings. I detest and deplore violence. But we have to bring peace. We have to sit down and we have to recognise the statehood of Palestine. Now we're in a difficult position because all along we, and I welcome that we're recognising Palestine as a state. But where is that state now? It has been utterly destroyed. What about peaceful coexistence of Palestinians with Israelis with the support of the international community?
Okay, I want to give Senator Chambers a chance to respond to that. I'll give you an opportunity to respond now, but also you mentioned a point there about the implications on Ireland and the offset of that. I think you're alluding to refugees and that coming to our shores from the likes of the Middle East. And you've come out with a very strong statement on that. You've called for asylum seekers who break the law to be deported. Is it not the case that can be done already, but it's just not being enforced?
Yeah, well, actually, I was asked a question, you know, should we be doing this? And I said, well, we do, and yes, because, but I will caveat that by saying the vast majority of people that come here fleeing war and persecution, you know, are not going to commit criminal acts. But it goes without saying that if somebody commits a serious indictable offence, of course they should be deported. And I think that would be supported by, I would say, most people in the country. And I don't think there would be an issue at any UF. But the question was put to me and I answered it. But just to respond to what Catherine said there, and, you know, I don't disagree with what Catherine is saying. And, you know, when we looked at what happened in Northern Ireland and we achieved peace there when we thought at times it would never happen. But, you know, 26 years ago, the Good Friday Agreement was signed and my party was instrumental in achieving that. And it's still a work in progress. But peace was only achieved when the bombs and the guns were put down and people got around the table to talk. And we're just not there yet in Israel and Palestine. But I do believe in my heart of hearts that we will get there. And peace is the only way out of this horror that we are witnessing every day. And, you know, when people ask the question, and, you know, we've got people coming here from lots of countries fleeing war and conflict, and clearly Ukraine is the one that we're most familiar with now, and the displacement of people. And when I get asked, why are you talking about this so much, and what about domestic issues? You know, when we look at what Putin has done in Ukraine and his illegal invasion, part of his objective is to destabilise the European Union, displacing 8 million people, sending them into the European Union, putting pressure on member states and having us deal with what is a very challenging migration crisis. That's part of his agenda, to destabilise our country and other countries. So these conflicts, even though they feel as though they are removed from us or they're far away, they have a direct impact here. We only have to look at the energy crisis and the cost of our bills following that war and Putin turning the tap off in terms of gas. So these international issues do have an impact here, not alone, you know, in real terms, but people, you know, look on and with horror and with grief and sadness, and they want their politicians to step in and do something on it. And, you know, as I said at the outset, Ireland was an outlier at the beginning. You know, we were out on our own at times when we were defending Palestine and pushing for funding and condemning Israel. And now, you know, more countries are coming on side and they're of our viewpoint as well. And I do think that pressure is coming to bear on Israel. So, you know, I do hope for peace and I think that we will get there. And I just think what's happening currently, and myself and Catherine in agreement, is just abhorrent on the Palestinian people.
Yeah, and we're getting quite a bit of that into on the text lines this morning. Why are you starting with Israel, that we have enough problems here in our own country? But there are knock-on implications to this country,
whether
that be migration, etc., etc. Just one final point, and it's another wedge issue that's going to be very to the fore as we come up to the elections. Housing, and I know you have an information meeting this evening, Lisa.
Yeah, I do. So look at housing, you know, when we go around to the doors, housing is, you know, every second door we get to, housing is the key issue. It is the key challenge of our generation. And, you know, we're making good progress. Momentum is behind house building now, 33,000 homes delivered last year, and that number will continue to increase. But the meeting I'm holding tonight is an information meeting on all of the different housing grants available to people to help them buy their own home, and information as well on all the retrofitting grants. So meeting tonight in the Connacht Hotel in Galway City at 7 p.m. We have Noreen McKenzie from Sherry Fitzgerald, financial advisor, Niall Brown from O'Donnell and Joyce as an auctioneer, Shane Murphy from Ashgrove Renewables to talk about the one-stop shop and the retrofit grants, and my colleague Senator Mary Fitzpatrick, who's our housing spokesperson, will take us through the different government grants like your first home equity scheme and your first time buyers grant. So there's a lot of support and assistance out there, but actually navigating it can be a bit tricky. There's a lot of details. So the meeting tonight at 7 o'clock in the Connacht Hotel aims to just go through all of those details. We'll be joined by our city councillors as well and our Oireachtas members, who will be on site to assist people as well with any information or help that they might require.
That's right. Senator Lisa Chambers and Deputy Catherine Conaghy, thank you both for joining us on Galway Talks on Galway Bay FM. Tell you, that's got you exercise this morning. Coming up next, we'll be looking at another international crisis, and I'm sure people will love to hear that. Sudan crisis 1 year on. The reason we're looking at this is because there's a local West of Ireland man who's very to the fore in the humanitarian work out there with the Jesuit Refugee Service as well. That's why we're doing it. So all that plus lots of more. Just to get to some of your comments very quickly that are coming in, and there's plenty of them coming in today. Why are you letting Lisa make speeches and not answer your questions? I did butt in and implore her for a few answers. Stop the waffle, Lisa. Answer the question on Shannon. She's totally avoiding it, John, says this listener. Another listener says Lisa Chambers is a waffler. Why are you letting Lisa Chambers waffle on? The point is arms travelling through Shannon, and you wouldn't make her answer the question. I implored her a few different ways, but that was the response I got. So you can make up your own minds from there. And there are some more requests coming through. I will get to them. Here's one. Have you anything else to talk about except for Israel? We are not going to solve the problem. They should sort out the hospital instead. It is desperate. And another listener says, I am disgusted with the content you opened your show with, straight over to the Middle East with all the problems we have going on in Galway. And they say that they voted for one of those that was on the programme but won't be doing so again, from a Galway listener. I support them, people in Shannon. They had great courage, as another listener, and they keep coming in, and we'll get to more of them as we go on this morning as well. Next up, it's Sudan. We have Shane Burke from the Jesuit Refugee Service.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Find hundreds of used cars to suit your budget in Windsor Motor Mall Galway, located on the Monavay Road.
Maintain a healthier life with good health naturally on Galway Talks with Evergreen Health Foods. Helen from Evergreen offers listeners advice on supporting your health naturally and making that step to a healthier you. Join Helen from Evergreen Health Foods for Good Health Naturally this Tuesday at 11:20 a.m. on Galway Talks with John Morley on Galway Bay FM.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome into today's programme. Delighted to say I'm joined on the line now by Shane Burke. And Shane works with the Jesuit Refugee Service in East Africa. Shane, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Talk to us about where you're calling in from today, Shane.
I'm calling from Nairobi in Kenya. This is where we have our regional office, where I'm based.
Okay, brilliant. Talk to us about the crisis in Sudan. It's been very bad there for over a year. And talk to us about the work you're doing, the humanitarian work you're doing.
Okay, yeah. The crisis in Sudan started last year, April. The conflict that occurred has resulted in massive displacement of people. In Sudan itself, about total of over 8 million people have been displaced. And about 1.5 to 2 million of those people have had to cross borders into other countries like Chad, Egypt, South Sudan. And we work closely in South Sudan with those who cross. So we deal with the refugees that leave Sudan and come into South Sudan. About 600,000 have crossed a certain point, a place called Rink. in South Sudan, and that's where we provide services such as psychosocial care, but also physiotherapy. So you get a lot of people with both physical and psychological issues and damage when they arrive across. So that's one of our main areas. And then we, for the working with the most vulnerable, we give sometimes food and non-food items. So it means plastic sheeting for shelter. It means mosquito nets, because also in this area, there's a lot of health issues such as cholera, malaria and so on. So this is our part in it. There's a lot of other organizations up there too, doing a lot of other areas in health. Education is missing, and that's something we also are hoping to work in.
Okay. Without getting into the complexities of it, there is a power struggle between two generals in the country, and it's led to this deadly conflict. Talk to us about some of the horrors that have unfolded over the past year.
So what's really happened, as you mentioned, these two generals have gone to war with each other in a power struggle, and just started bombing. It started in Khartoum, the capital city, which is a city of typically 6 million people, but now 3 million are gone, have left. But also a lot of the conflict between these two leaders has taken place in Darfur, in the west of Sudan, where really quite large groups of people have been killed. And it's really it's like a genocide opposed to anything else that's taking place there. So a lot of people are displaced. They run. As part of this, unfortunately, there's a lot of beatings and sexual violence also. So by the time people arrive across the border to safety, they're in bad shape, based on some of them with gun wounds, some of them with serious trauma due to assault and sexual abuse. So all of these are what arrive to us in the reception centers and the transit centers where people come in, and now some refugee camps that are starting. So this and the worst bit, I suppose, or one of the more tragic parts of this, is it's the biggest displacement of children globally. Never have so many children been displaced in a conflict. So you find many children that are unaccompanied. So they require obviously a lot more help. And that's the horror of the war that's taking place. And it has a huge impact, of course, on the economy. So there's a big fear of famine now coming up in Sudan, which will now increase further the issue.
Now, Shane, you are the Deputy Regional Director of the Jesuit Refugee Service East Africa Region, and you're leading teams operating in both Chad and South Sudan. Talk to us about the work ye do there. It's essential and sometimes basic as well, but it's vital work for these people. I know you're involved in a whole wide raft of areas, including education, counselling and peace building as well.
Yeah, thank you. In Chad, we work very much in the education sector. So before this conflict in Sudan, JRS were already in that area of Chad working with previous displaced people from Darfur. So we were ready to respond in Chad. So JRS worked closely with teaching refugee teachers also to integrate them now into the schooling systems so they can also help. So that's one of the main areas for JRS in Chad. In South Sudan, as I mentioned, it's mostly psychosocial care and trying to get into education, but due to challenges with resources, we're staying focused on the psychosocial care. But then we work closely with communities, because what we have now in South Sudan is we have the local community, we have the refugees coming in, and we have previously displaced refugees from Sudan. So you have a lot of different ethnic groups. And the whole challenge that took place originally in Sudan is basically a collision of ethnicities, religion, and culture. So we have to deal with that, and we deal with that through reconciliation. So we would work a lot in dialogue with the local communities and through village structures, where you have already strong community structures in place. So it's quite a positive way of working with conflict, or the potential of conflict in our contexts. We also organise a lot of sport events to bring community together, football matches, things like this, and it works very well with the youth especially.
Now, as you've alluded to, the UN officials have said that millions of people in Sudan are on the brink of starvation, but they've said as well that there's no money for humanitarian aid. I know that ministers are gathering in Paris today. Are you confident that there will be aid given to the humanitarian crisis?
I can't say I'm confident. I'm obviously very aware of the global situation and the competition, if you like, that exists in terms of global funding for these causes. So I wouldn't say I'm confident. Just recently, I've learned that World Food Programme are going to close their operation in Chad, for example, where 1.2 million people depend on that food daily. So now you take that away, it's a huge challenge to try and cope. In Sudan itself, now is the start of the harvest season, and there's going to be no harvest done. And that's the real fear of the oncoming famine, because if the harvest could happen and there could be some normality, you would just have the normal level of challenge. But now it's obviously exasperated with this. So no, I don't hold massive confidence. And I say that also because there has been a significant decline in funds. The trend is there over the last 2 or 3 years. I think the figure that for Sudan is maybe between 5% and 10% of the needed funding is what's on the table at the moment.
Okay,
that's very low.
And Ireland is, I suppose, historically one of the biggest charitable countries in the world in terms of per capita, what we donate to different causes. And I know the Troker Appeal has been very good to a lot of different countries in Africa and the African region as well. Do you feel like there's an appetite in Ireland to support the cause out there? Because famine, of course, and starvation is very close to our own hearts here.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, not just because I'm Irish, but because it's a fact, the Irish people are always brilliant in terms of responding. But, you know, in the end of the day, you can only respond to so much. And I recognize that reality too. But I always have a lot of trust and faith in the Irish people, that they understand a lot, and they have a very positive and understanding way of engaging with this kind of conflict and famines, etc. Because, as you say, we have a history that has these things in it, and it's much easier for us maybe to react. But for me, I always feel very happy about the response of the Irish.
And do you have any plans of coming back to Sligo anytime soon to rally a bit of support?
Well, I'll come back and have a rest anyway. probably in August, I'll try and get back for a week in August. Maybe I'll actually even be in Galway. But I don't have a plan in terms of rallying, but certainly taking a break. We're doing as much as we can out on this side. And also JRS have an international office in Rome. And then we have the Jesuit office in Dublin. So for me, that's also just an opportunity now just to say that any support that can or would be willing to be offered, it can be given through the office in Dublin, the Irish Jesuit International IJI office. They would welcome support, and then they would directly support us. But bigger than that is just to create the awareness, John. I mean, just to the opportunity now just to speak and just to give a little bit of a time to create awareness on this conflict. As I say, the biggest child displacement scenario globally at the moment, yet it doesn't get much media attention. The long-term impact of this and famine can be phenomenal on the country, because you have children who don't develop in the same way. It means you have an economy that doesn't have the people that can run it at the critical level. And that's, for the long term, a real concern, you know, for these countries, because then they become more, it just keeps the dependence there.
When you are in Galway, do come into us, Shane, and give us an update on all the work you're doing out there as well. But Shane Burke, the Deputy Region Director of the Jesuit Refugee Service in East Africa Region, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. If you want to get your messages into us, do so on our text and WhatsApp number. That's 086-383-553. That is our text and WhatsApp number. You can even voice note there if you want. We will check them before we play them out on air. You can phone Siobhan on reception on 0917700077. Email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. Now, between now and 10 o'clock, we're looking all about diabetes, and Galway researchers are developing a series of short empathy experiences to better understand living with diabetes. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Dr. Sarah Gundy, a public engagement officer with Coram. Sarah, good morning.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us in studio today. Talk to me about this research you're doing, and what exactly are empathy kits?
Yes, that's a good question. Most people probably wouldn't have heard of them before. So we have a new project called Empathy Detectives, which is funded by the Science Foundation Ireland Discover Programme. Mm-hmm. And we are partnering with Ideas Lab and PPI Ignite at the University of Galway to increase public understanding of living with diabetes. So at the moment, we're establishing a panel of people living with diabetes or caring for a person with diabetes. And we're going to work with our panel to develop short empathy experiences in the form of mobile empathy kits. And through these kits, people will experience what it's like living with diabetes, and we hope to increase the public understanding of lived experiences with diabetes. And you're probably wondering, what's an empathy experience?
Yes.
Well, I can't tell you because we haven't created the ones for the experiences of living with diabetes, but I can tell you what we've done in the past around a project we had with living with arthritis. Mm-hmm. So for the Babro Festival and Science Week, we created empathy experiences around what it's like living with arthritis in the knee and the hands. So we restricted the mobility of a person's knee, just with like a simple knee brace, and had them try to do simple activities like standing up and sitting down or tying their shoe, just to get a feel of what it's like to have that restriction and how it can make such simple activities be a bit more difficult.
Okay, so it's for people who don't have diabetes to experience what it's like to live with diabetes.
Exactly.
That put simply.
Yes, it's yes. So you can walk in their shoes.
Okay, and how does that actually work in practice?
So we haven't created the experience for diabetes, and that's why we need to establish our panel.
Okay.
Because we need to learn from the people who are living with diabetes or caring for a person with diabetes, and we are recruiting at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so if anyone wants to be on this panel, we have a call for action out on the PPI Network's webpage. And if you are living with diabetes or are caring for a person with diabetes and want to help us develop these empathy experiences, you can go to the website and get involved. And the website is ppinetwork.ie.
Okay. And what sort of commitment do you need from the people taking part in this?
We'll meet online for 1 hour for 8 to 10 sessions, and you will be reimbursed for your time because you are making a valuable contribution.
Okay. And the start date for all this is the beginning of June?
Yes, we hope to establish our panel in May and have our first meeting by the end of May or beginning of June.
And the closing date to contact and get involved in all this around May, is it?
The closing date will be 2 weeks from today.
Okay. And so is people with diabetes and without, and any particular type, type 1, type 2, or how does that work?
We are casting our net wide. We want all different types of diabetes and all different experiences, all ages, because there are a range of people and experiences that we want to learn from.
Because some people can be born with diabetes.
Exactly.
And some develop it later in life as well.
Exactly. That we want type 1, type 2, any sort of experience.
And I know a lot of work is being done in the Coram and the Ideas Lab based there in the University of Galway on a lot of different subjects indeed. But talk to us about the work you've been doing to date with diabetes.
Well, we're a medical devices research institute. So we are helping people live with chronic illnesses such as diabetes. And we, for example, on the diabetes projects that we work with, we want to have a drug delivery mechanism that's much more patient-friendly. So rather than injecting the insulin, we're trying to find a better way for the patient to take their insulin. For example, maybe a patch that they would put on the inside of their cheek to deliver the insulin, which is much more comfortable.
At what stage would that type of technology be at the moment?
That's it, the initial stages at the moment, and just figuring out the drug delivery mechanisms and the materials that we need.
Because I think we had someone on with diabetes very recently, actually, and I suppose the complications of having that needle and going around, if you were to go,
it is
a concern for people who live with the illness.
Exactly, and that's why we want to establish this patient panel and learn how best we can make their lives more comfortable.
Okay. Dr. Sarah Gundy, the Public Engagement Officer with Corum, thanks indeed for joining us on Galway Talks on Galway Bay FM. To your comments now, very quickly, and I can tell you that we have birthday requests coming in today as well, if I can find them. Happy 21st birthday to our daughter Sarah from her mum, dad, sisters Zoe and Alicia and brother Liam. Best of luck to you with your exams as well. So that's just a flavour. There's a big comment coming in. I'll get to that after 10 o'clock as well. But if you want to get involved in the programme, 086-3833-553. That is our text and WhatsApp number. You can phone Siobhan on reception on 091-77-0077 and email comments at goawaybayfm.ie. Coming up between 10 and 11, we have a lot on the programme today, including we're speaking to a local election candidate who's also going to be running on the Labour ticket in Europe. Fergal Landy of Oranmore-Mary comes into us and talks about why he is running for Labour in Europe. As well as that, we have the Dip a Day in May. That's the great fundraiser by the Galway Simon community. And we'll also be talking to Fintan Maher about the whole HAP situation and all that, plus lots more coming up after news at 10. Very good morning to you.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Drive happy in Windsor Motor Mall, Galway, with hundreds of used cars to suit your budget.